Hello, and welcome to Dressing Room Confidential, a podcast in which a sometimes working actor chats to working actors in their dressing rooms. I am your host, Sean McConaughey, the sometimes working actor. And on this episode of DRC, I chat to John Trindle, who is in the play War Horse over at the New London Theatre here in London. And it was a bit of a special one because John and I actually shared a dressing room when we did Sweet Bird of Youth over at the Old Vic last year. So it was really great reconnecting with him and seeing his new dressing room and chatting to him about what it was like to work on a show like War Horse. If you don't know anything or if you know very little about War Horse. War Horse is the young adult book that was turned into a stage play and then turned into a feature film directed by Steven Spielberg. It's about World War One. It's about a boy and his horse. And the stage play is amazing. It's won Olivier. It's won all these Tonys and awards. And it's the one with the mechanical horse puppets. It's a really cool play because it's one of these jobs, if you're cast in any production of War Horse, whether it be the West End show or one of the touring ones or whatever, it's almost like a temping service for actors because it's so physical and it's so intense and it's such a specific skill that you learn, the puppet skills that you learn when you work on a show like War Horse, that it becomes almost like a temping service for actors, because once you do it, you can leave for like 6 months and then they're like, hey, we need somebody to be the ass end of the horse. You free, then you show up and you do it, and it's really cool. So I chatted to John about that. But first, we're going to chat to my lover, the incomparable Donla Hughes, as she consoles me after a professional tragedy befalls yours truly. Let's listen to that right now. Do you feel like you're being interrogated? Yeah. What do you want to talk about?
I don't know, maybe...
I want to talk about getting dropped by my agent.
Oh. Okay.
You got dropped by an agent.
I did.
How'd that go?
It was cozy. Well, there's always going to be mixed feelings about it, because I think if you're about to get dropped by your agent, the chances are that they've not been getting you seen for very good stuff anyway. So it's like the band-aid that you wanted to rip off yourself, but then they rip it off and you're like, fuck you, I wanted to rip it off. So I think that's the mixed emotion of relief, but also usually I suppose it's not very nice for the ego. It's always a little unsettling when your fate is decided for you.
You got dropped by letter.
I got dropped by an email that said, sorry to have to send you this letter. So his assistant didn't even bother fucking printing out the letter.
And did you feel like scum?
No, I never feel like scum.
What? How?
Because I think my base level of self-hatred is fairly solid. Oh. It doesn't dip below a certain level. Yeah, but my childhood was far too happy to feel like scum. But I did feel like shit.
If you're an actor and you don't have an agent, or you get dropped by your agent, do other actors look at you like scum?
No, but they often look at you with a sense of pity, which sucks.
Yeah.
No one wants to be pitied.
I think I disagree. I think most actors do look at you like scum.
That's through the prism of your own.
No, because I have.
You've looked at other actors like scum?
I think it's natural, yeah, because especially like when you go through, you go to a place like a drama school like Lambda or any of the big drama schools, any drama school. And you kind of go, well, now I'm going to get an agent, right? Like, that's the promise in a way, that you're going to get an agent.
Yeah.
And of course, like, there's a few people, like, when you're in your first year, and the people in their final year don't have an agent. They don't leave with an agent. Mm-hmm. You kind of go, well, that's not going to happen to me.
Oh, yeah, sure.
Because there was only two people who didn't get an agent in that class, and I'm not going to be one of those two. And there's, like, this weird promise that you're going to get an agent, and you leave, and if you get dropped by an agent, it means that you're really shit, or you're uncastable. You know, you're not viable. You're not a viable option, and you're not a viable commodity. Because that's what it is. We're dealing in commodities now.
Yes, but hang on. I think that is something that a naive drama student or someone who's not in the industry for very long feels. But if you've been working in the industry for more than 3 or 4 years, and you still think that, then you really need to sort of readjust how you react to the world, because that is so
But it's still there. It's still relevant. You can't tell, we can't go out there to all these actors and be like, don't look at people who get dropped at being scum, because it's there. I think it's definitely there. It definitely is there. Like, it's like a disease, like, you don't want to catch. It's kind of like, I got dropped. It's like, oh. And they take a step back. And
damaged,
like,
goods.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, you can't, I mean, like with so many things, when you're in drama school, you cannot tell someone who is a few years behind you in that, because like, it's of all careers and of all situations, it just really does make no sense. And there's a sort of a period of adjustment between the idealism of youth and kind of, I think, coming into this industry will batter that down very quickly, and you can respond to it in the right way and take it as a sort of a strength, or you can become, you know, start that journey of being slightly bitter and...
What if you were already bitter?
Well, it's, you know, I think maybe you're an unusual case, because most drama students... are not, because to be in a situation where you're in drama school, it means that usually a lot of the right things have aligned to get you there in the first place. You know, someone who grows up the son of a heroin addict and a fucking bully.
My dad wasn't on heroin.
Oh no, I'm not abusing. I'm not talking about your folks. Jesus Christ. I'm saying someone who, you know, who grows up in that sort of situation is probably not going to end up at fucking RADA. Like, you know,
you're so classist.
A lot of kids in drama school, I'm not saying it's nothing to do with actually class, really. It's more to do with love and support. You know, I think it's a fair assumption, one that I'm comfortable making, that most people who end up in drama school come from relatively blessed backgrounds. So therefore, I don't think that by the age of 20, they're likely to be very bitter individuals, because the chances are that they've had a lot of things happen in the right way for them.
Mm.
And certainly the validation of getting into a good drama school is, and at that age in your life, is a really, really massive pat on the back.
Mm.
I mean, I remember teachers telling us in first year, you know, how we were pedigree, and like, you're going to believe that, you know, you know, like, I'm one of 2,000 girls that auditioned and it's me, I'm here, like... That's as much and all as you want to sort of be grounded and everything. That's definitely going to have an impact on your confidence and scrape away any possible bitterness that you might have been beginning to foster.
Huh.
Slightly different maybe for you, because you were a little bit older, so you had a bit.
Jaded.
You know.
Bitter. Pissed off. Cynical. Angry. Non-committal. Depressed. Sad.
Covered in bed bug bites.
Covered in bed bugs.
Dealing with English food.
So you didn't get bitter after your agent dropped you?
I think I definitely nearly went down a path of being bitter in that adjustment period after drama school. It took a while because I had 6 months of work, and then there was the trying to hustle to get an agent and trying to reconcile.
Because you were one of the ones that left without an agent.
I did, yeah.
How'd that feel, leaving drama school without an agent? Like scum.
Well, no, because I had sort of that. It was, if anything, gonna develop almost more of an initial sort of chip on the shoulder / strength, depending on how you look at it. But because I had a job and it was sort of a little bit of an FU to the system, well, I've got 6 months of work, so I have been validated. Thank you very much. So agents, you know, should have seen past the wigs.
What was the 6 months of work?
BBC radio drama. So 6 months of work, great learning and everything, but not something where someone's going to go, I want that girl, she's a star, you know.
Yeah.
Well, it was its own bubble, it was never going to lead to anything else. So then finishing that, I was still at square one.
Mm.
And that's when I think the road to potential bitterness began.
Mm.
But I recognised that a while in. It was just learning the lesson that I think is a lot of... a lot of young actors learn. I've seen it in so many other actors. You kind of work with these smart, driven, talented people who actually could have done a number of things. I did very well in university, very well in school, so it wasn't sort of like, this is the only thing I can do. And so that kind of, that period of adjustment between always being able to work hard and do well, because you worked hard. That's always been how life has kind of reinforced what I've done. I went to university, kind of went, cool, I'm enjoying this, I'm going to work hard and then I'll get an A. Great, work hard, get an A. And you can't do that in acting.
Mm.
There is no correlation, and beginning to...
Meritocracy doesn't really...
No. No, it's completely irrelevant. That was, I think, the hardest thing for me to reconcile. And I feel like now I really have made peace with that.
Mm.
Because there was definitely a period, there was a couple of years of having to adjust to that, and it was sort of sink or swim. And, you know, you either let yourself go down that road or else you just have to absolutely not ever engage with feeling sad about how it's unfair or whatever else, because you've chosen this career.
Mm.
So just be fucking happy. You know,
it hurts to be happy.
I don't think it hurts to be happy. I think
it gives me a weird feeling.
No, I think
kind of like when I sing in tune and I'm like, I don't like this feeling of singing in tune, so now I'm going to sing out of tune.
I disagree that it hurts to be happy, but I do think it takes a certain lack of pride to be happy, because sometimes you have to allow yourself...
What are you saying?
I think you have to allow yourself to be a bit more stupid than you might want to be happy. Oh. You have to not engage with,
so you're calling me
all
smart.
The arguments. Sure, I'm calling you smart.
Thank
you're
you.
Fucking genius.
Yeah, that makes me happy. Quick, hit me. Quick, tell me I'm shit. Quick, be like my mom.
Shut up.
Criticize me, please.
So your reaction to losing your agent was of the scum feeling variety. I think you're smarter than that. I don't think you actually felt like scum. Come on.
Oh, thank you. It was a funny one, because I kind of felt like it was gonna happen. Because I got the feeling, not that I was shit, and because I like booked a couple of jobs, so it was kind of like, you know, if you go on a you go on a 6 month run and you're not booking anything,
yeah,
then you kind of worry. Even I've heard people go for like a year without booking stuff, and they're like, oh, my agent's gonna drop me. And then that didn't happen. I booked a couple of things. I got penciled for a couple of things, so I was kind of like, oh, my stroke gray is going all right.
Mm.
This is impressing them. But I got the feeling that she didn't like me as a person. So, and like, she never really wanted to see me or talk to me.
Or hang out.
Anything. She didn't want anything to do with me after signing me and telling me how great I was. So I was just kind of like, I wouldn't be surprised if she fucking drops me.
Mm.
And then when it happened, the circumstances surrounding it were so ridiculous that I was kind of like... Yeah, I went through the stages of grief. The first one being like shock. I was just kind of like, are you fucking joking me right now? Are you serious? And then I was sad, because I was like, now I don't have an agent. And then I was angry. And now I'm relieved, because yeah, she definitely didn't like me as a person.
And at
the same time, you know, I think being here in London as an American is just a fool's errand in a way.
Well, I think being an actor is a fool's errand, so you're just going a level up. But once you're fucking playing the fool game, it's
yeah,
really
but like
rare, you know,
but like there are more American parts in America.
Sure. Yeah,
you know, and so, sure, you can carve out a certain niche here in London, but in a way, I don't think this might be a gross generalization and taking a pot shot, but I don't think English audiences really want to see Americans on stage. Even if it's an American play, they don't want to see Americans on stage.
Yeah, yeah.
Whereas in America, I think we're much more Anglophiles. Like, mm. give us all the Brits. We don't like your
yeah.
politics and we don't like your history, but we love your actors
yeah.
and your
yeah.
culture.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
And your royalty.
You get that sense from English actors here. They definitely are very welcome mm. there in the industry.
Yeah,
and
yeah.
respect of the type of training that is done here.
Like Sweet Bird of You, those 22 cast members.
Mm.
And me and Seth were the only Americans.
Yeah.
What?
Yeah, 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 yeah.
So that's a bit, yeah. So that's why I'm going to LA. Bye! So yeah, there it is. My chat with Dunla when she was trying to console me after I got dropped by my agent. So I guess the sometimes working actor is now going to be the never working actor. But screw it, you know, representation doesn't equal talent, talent doesn't equal representation. These things happen. But let's chat with John Trindle. Here we go.
So let me set this up. Yeah. I learned a lot about microphones. I've learned a lot about sound. So yeah, so I'll set that up there because they don't want to hear me. They want to hear you.
Oh God! What are we actually doing?
What are we talking about? First of all, is your phone off?
No.
Can you turn it off? That's possible.
Yeah,
I know you're a busy guy. Just
I'm
yeah.
gonna send an email out to everyone.
Basically, this is just where I talk to actors, working actors. It's a sometimes working actor talking to working actors in their dressing room.
Yeah, okay.
I want this to be sort of like a podcast where it's the shit that like the big guys don't really worry about.
Yeah.
It's the shit that we worry about.
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah.
And it's good to get insights into that.
Yeah.
Because some people be like, fuck, I'm going through the same thing. I wonder, just have peace of mind or kind of like, oh, that's insightful, you know?
Yeah.
That's useful for me. So yeah, it's just okay. Shit like that.
Cool.
So where's your spot? Is this your spot?
This is my spot. Yep. Josh.
Is that your character?
No.
Who the fuck is Josh? This isn't your spot at all, is it? Is this your dressing room? Are you in the show?
Oh shit.
I'm not even in the show. This is One Man, Two Governors, right?
Oh god.
Oh fuck.
Oh god, wrong stage door. That's it.
So confusing.
So this guy here, he's injured, so he's like done something to his back. Yeah, he's been off like for months.
For real?
Yeah, like 7 months or something.
And so is this actually your spot?
Yeah.
Oh fuck.
Yeah, I'm like temporary spot.
So this is, the show is War Horse.
Yes.
We should specify what you're doing. So you're doing War Horse.
Yeah, so at the moment I'm doing ensemble stuff in War Horse. So basically picking up anything that anyone isn't doing. Because it's a long run, people get holidays and people get injured because it's a physical show.
Yeah.
So I do lots of like little bits of puppeteering, village characters, soldiers, German soldiers, wounded soldiers, village characters, a boat, you know, like puppeteering, you know what I mean? Like puppeteering boats, puppeteering crows, hoofing, you know, which is like four people hoofing the horse so it looks like it's going fast but in slow motion without putting too much strain on the puppeteers themselves.
So how, does that change every night? Or is it pretty much the same every night?
Usually it's like at the beginning of the week, that's usually your set track for that week.
Yeah.
But people will get injured, so that might change. A few different things will change and stuff like that. Because if one person gets injured, it means one person might have to step up to that part, which means someone else has to step into that part. So it all moves around if one person's off.
Right.
It's just like, oh god, okay, you've really got to like concentrate and know what you're doing for the week, otherwise you're in trouble.
That's crazy.
John Trindle to the stage, please.
Oh god, no.
Not again.
So this is, but this isn't your first go-around on this show.
It isn't, no. So I did it before Sweetbird. So I finished last March and I was playing Billy, who is... I played Billy and I understudied Albert. So Albert's the lead boy who, his horse is the horse that goes off to war.
Mm-hmm.
And then his journey is trying to find that horse and ultimately they do come back together. But I played Billy, who was his cousin, who is almost like a spoiled little brat, wanted the horse, lost out because Albert's dad is an alcoholic and wanted to beat his brother and would bid more money to get the horse. And Billy's a bit upset by that, then gets drafted for the war because he's old enough to go, and sort of has a bit of a tragic ending. So he starts as a bit of a little shit and then becomes really vulnerable. So I think for an audience, they sort of see him at first, they're a bit like, what a horrible, horrible boy. And then as it goes on, you're like, oh God, I really feel for him. And then he sort of ends up being killed at war. And then I would like do some, after that bit, I'd do some puppetry stuff. And
yeah.
stuff like that. So,
so it's been an amazing gig.
Cracking gig. Yeah. Yeah. It's amazing. And I think that's what's fun about it, is that, like, you're never doing the same thing. Even if, like, you're one of the lead boys or something, you will always have to do a bullet pole or, like, be a boat or something, just because someone might not be able to do it.
Yeah.
And so it doesn't, it always, it's always felt like an ensemble show. It's never felt like them and us, or there's no divide in us.
Yeah.
And being, there's like 35 people, I think, in the cast. So like,
what?
Yeah.
What?
Yeah. So they have to get a real, they have to choose the actors and puppeteers well.
Yeah. Yeah.
Otherwise
yeah.
it could, like, for a year, it could be a bit of a mare, but I think they've always done pretty well.
Yeah. So wait, so how did you get into acting? Let's go all the way back.
So all the way back. So I...
when
I
your dad, when I met your dad, he said that you were in Oliver.
Yeah.
So was that at the start?
Started, yeah. So when I was at primary school, I was in the choir. Had like a really nice little voice. And then my music teacher saw that like they were doing an open audition for Oliver. And she was like, oh, you should go along to it. So, you know, you just sort of do what your teachers say, don't you? So I was like, all right, fair enough. And then, so I went along to this open audition, and there were thousands of people outside this Royal Welsh Centre, I think it was. And, like, kids dressed up as the Artful Dodger, dressed up as Oliver, singing in the queue.
What?
Yeah, like, mad. And I just stood there with a packet of Doritos, like, in my tracksuit bottoms. Like, oh, mate, what is this all about? And then we were getting so close to the front, and I was like, do you know what? I just don't even want to do it. Like, I was like, I think I was about 10 years old. I was like, I'm not going to do it. And my stepdad was like, we've been standing here for 2 hours. You are going in that room. Doesn't matter what happens, you're going in there. I was like, cool. Went in there, had to sing a song. I think they taught us a little dance or something. And then I ended up getting like a part in the ensemble as like one of the kids. So I did that when I was 10. And then they asked me back when I was 12. Did like a Royal Variety performance as well. And then from then I sort of realised I liked it, but wasn't sure still. I didn't really know I wanted to do it. And then I went to school, and my best mate was saying that he wanted to apply for the Brit School. And then, so not wanting to be separated from him, I was like, cool, I'm going to do exactly the same thing.
So what's the Brit School, just for some of the American
Well, Brit School listeners. Is like, it's a performing arts school here. So you can do any strand from dance, theatre, musical theatre, art, design, music, you know, so you sort of get lots of creatives in one building.
And crazy people have gone there, like Adele. That was
Adele went there, Amy Winehouse was there, loads of, Leona Lewis was there.
That's crazy.
Loads of, there's quite a lot of people coming through now as well. I think Jesse J was there and stuff like that. So,
and so that's where you went.
That's where I went. Yeah, and I had Rob Ems was there with me, and Bryony Hannah, who's a big stage actress over here, is with one of my best mates, John, who was there. You know, like lots of people came out of there.
And how old were you when you went there?
So I was 14 when I started there. So,
oh, wow.
You sort of did your GCSEs, like the final 2 years of GCSEs, and then your 2 years of A-levels,
mm-hmm.
Which is a B-tech, really. So I chose to do theatre as my B-tech. So you come out of there when you're, I think, 17, 18.
Wow.
Yeah. But yeah, that was the thing. My
but you're immersed in this whole
Like everything around environment. You is creative. Like people playing music in the stairwell, like... You know, it's just like, it's amazing, actually. Looking back on it, I was really lucky. And the facilities were amazing.
Yeah.
Because
it's a weird thing. Like, you know, some people... I mean, I think we all sort of like to slag off wherever we went to.
Yeah.
Do you know what
Naturally,
I mean?
Naturally, yeah.
Because you kind of see some of the imperfections while you're there. But then, just hearing about it sometimes, it seems like the Brit School is a pretty fucking cool place.
Yeah. And I think when I was there, it'd been open 9 years, maybe 10 years. And so it was just becoming quite established.
Yeah.
I mean, I don't know what it's like now, but when I was there, everyone, most of the kids there were like working class kids, and it was a free school, and it was just these kids that wanted to, I don't know, they weren't academic, but they had something, you know, they wanted to do something, they wanted to be creative, and it seemed like, and it was the perfect environment for them.
Yeah.
And yeah, just, yeah, like you say, like everyone being in such a creative atmosphere, being able to produce plays and get the musicians in to have a little score under it, and you know, yeah, stuff like yeah. that. It's just, yeah, it was amazing. It was amazing.
That's so cool.
Yeah, I felt very lucky.
So what did you do after that?
So then after that, I sort of, not took a break, but I had like a year out from college and went, did a bit of travelling. And then I wanted to go to drama school, so applied to drama school. Didn't get in anywhere first year. Second year I applied, sort of got on a waiting list for a couple of places. Then I got into a place called the Poor School, and I was just eager to get on with it. So yeah. instead of like feeling like I should wait and try and get into some of the places I'm on the waiting list for, I went to the Poor School, which is bonkers. Like,
I forgot to tell you, we rehearsed at the Poor School.
Yeah. Oh, did you?
For our cola, like the first week we were at the Poor School.
It's nuts, isn't it?
That place is crazy, man.
It's crazy. Was he there? Was
yeah, he was there a couple of times.
Yeah. Yeah, so the Poor School was like something where you work during the day, you go there in the evening and weekends. So you're basically working during the day to pay for it. And the director, I mean, I guess I shouldn't really say too much, but he was bonkers, right? He was an alcoholic.
He's like storied though. Like, he is like this weird yeah. legend.
Yeah, like, he's incredible. And everyone seems to know about him. You're like, oh, I went to the Poor School. Like, oh, the director there, right? Crazy, right? Like, yeah, he's crazy. And it just, your rehearsal always depended on whether he had a good day at the bookies or not. You know, like, if he'd won some money, everything you were doing was perfect.
Yeah,
and
yeah,
if
yeah.
he'd lost money, he'd be kicking radiators across the room and cancelling rehearsals, you know, so.
Well, I heard, like, he knew his stuff, right?
He did, yeah. He does. Like, he would say things, like, actually, that makes a lot of sense. But yeah. it just depended on how often you'd get that.
Yeah.
Like,
I love that, man. I mean, yeah. it's like our business is so mucky and weird that
yeah.
I love that there are madmen out there still.
Yeah, and he's, you know? He is brilliant, and he's just like a maverick.
Yeah.
And the place, the thing about the Poor School, it wasn't training you to have like a good voice or like good physical movements. He was just teaching you how to act.
Yeah.
And like sort of where to get that from, I guess, from past feelings, really.
Yeah.
And he was bonkers, but I loved it, and I loved him. Some people couldn't deal with it. I think we started with like 45 people in our year and ended up with 23.
Whoa.
Yeah, people wow. leaving or being kicked out.
Right, right.
Just couldn't stand it. But it meant that the 23 that were left were sort of really bonded together and
yeah.
just got on with it. You
like
know,
a like, platoon.
Yeah. Yeah, it really was like that. And then, so yeah, I finished there, and then didn't get an agent or anything like that, like, did showcases and all that sort of thing. A casting director saw me called Susie Coral, I think her name was, and she put me up for like this short film, which I didn't get, but she knew somebody who was casting the tour of Equus, and so she got me in touch with them. I went up for that as like an understudy and to play a horse, which I got, and then I went on tour for I think 5 months working with Thea Sharrock, and Simon Cowell was in it.
Fuck.
Callow, sorry. You hate yeah. that. God, he's everywhere. Simon Cowell was in it with Alfie Allen, who's now sort of
oh,
Game
shit.
Of Thrones.
Yeah. So you were in that, you were understanding that production?
Yeah.
Oh, man.
Yeah, which was pretty cool, man. Like, and got to go on a few times.
With Callow?
Yeah.
Whoa!
Yeah.
What was that like?
Amazing. He was amazing, like, just unbelievable.
Yeah. Was he good?
Yeah.
Yeah, yeah.
I loved him. I thought he was brilliant.
Yeah.
And that's the thing about him. You turn up for the first day of the read-through, and he's off book. Like, for the read-through, everyone's, like, reading, and he's, like, doing this amazing performance, and you're like, wow, I've got to up my game.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? Like, everyone in the room's like, oh, God, this is embarrassing. The whole play is him, and he knew it.
Yeah.
And, like, wow, that's amazing. So he doesn't. He's never been lazy. He's always like being on top of his game.
Yeah.
He was brilliant, and the production was brilliant, I think.
Yeah.
And then yeah, I luckily got an agent from that, who saw me in an understudy performance. But then, I was with him for a bit and didn't do anything for like 2 years, maybe.
Right.
A year and a half.
You're just like auditioning and stuff.
Yeah, a few auditions, but even then, not that much. Like,
yeah.
Maybe a couple of adverts and went up for a couple of fringe productions. Then I ended up getting in with a company called The Factory because of Colin Hurley, who was in Equus with me, and I started doing stuff with them and did a play with them called Boiling Frogs and did Hamlet with them, just playing like a small part. And then my agent got me a job at Theatre 503, but just before he got that, he realised that they couldn't keep me on and he was leaving. So I got this job and then got dropped from my agency.
Fuck.
So I was like, oh God, here I am again, like back to square one, you know. Like,
so you had an agent, got a job, and then your agent left.
Yeah.
And couldn't bring you to the new...
Couldn't bring me to the new agency. Because he's starting sort of quite low as an assistant again, almost.
And you didn't want to stay at that agency?
He sort of suggested I didn't, because I think a few of their agents were leaving and no one knew who I was and I was just going to get lost. So he said it's probably better to get out there on your own and try and find something else.
God.
Which was...
Were you kind of thinking like, well, screw it, I'm going to 503, so...
Yeah, I was thinking, well, I've got
this
play.
A job.
Yeah, I've got a job. Obviously, I'm gutted. I'm not going to have an agent, but at least I can invite people.
Yeah.
Invited people, no one really came. So I left that production with no sort of contacts or anything. I was like, oh God, this is awful. This is awful. But luckily The Factory was around and I was carrying on with The Factory. They had like a sister company called Sprite Productions, which are based up in Ripley, and they produced some of The Factory stuff. And then so I got in a play with them. I got into Macbeth, played Lennox, which was amazing, sort of on the grounds of this castle. And
what?
I met, yeah, it was like on the sort of this old castle, an outdoor production of Macbeth. It was amazing sometimes, and then sometimes it was pissing with the rain and freezing, and you're like, this is the wrong game. I have not chosen well.
This is the wrong game.
I should be in an office earning a lot of money. That'd be much better. But luckily I met a lovely, lovely girl called Laura Cubitt, who had been in Warhorse and knew that they were re-auditioning. And she sent a letter to the director and said, look, I know this guy, are there any parts available? And then there were some puppetry parts and some ensemble parts, and so they got me in for an audition. Luckily, you know, like word of mouth, just I didn't know nothing about it. Got me in for an audition. I found out about 3 days before they started rehearsals that I'd got this part. And then I was in it for a year and a half. So I did a year, first of all, just like puppeteering, and then for 6 months, that's when I started playing Billy and understudying Albert.
And this is like, this is the Warhorse in the West End.
Yeah, Warhorse West End. So it's transferred from the National, gone to the New London Theatre on Drury Lane. So like, it's a massive step. You know, I haven't got an agent.
Yeah.
I've sort of felt like I'm in the graveyard a little bit. You know, like, did a couple of fringe productions, and then all of a sudden I'm playing one of the principals in a West End show. Like, I could, you know what I mean? Like, couldn't believe it. Just like, wow, this is... unbelievable. And then did that, tried to get an agent and stuff, but because it's like 5 years old here now,
no
one wanted to come. Like, no agents, no casting directors. So again, like, comes to March and I'm like, oh God, I'm back on the scrap heap. Like, no one knows who I am. I've been in this play for a year and a half, which is like one of the most successful shows in the West End, but no one knows who I am. And then luckily Sarah Bird, who cast me in Equus when I came out of drama school, I tried to get her along and she couldn't come, but she was casting Sweet Bird of Youth for Marianne Elliott, who directed Warhorse, and she got me in for the part of Bud in Tennessee Williams' play, and luckily got it. Like, again, like, it's just sort of, it's like you're riding by the skin of your pants, you know, like, God, I've got to get this, I've got to do it. And then luckily did, and then did that for 4 months, Some agents came along but didn't sign anyone. No one signed me. But then afterwards, another casting director who knew me and seen my work got me in touch with an agency called Seinu, who decided they wanted to sign me. So then I signed with them about 3 months ago. I've luckily come back to Warhorse to help out, and then they've got me this part in a play at the West Yorkshire Playhouse, playing Curly in Of Mice and Men.
What?
Yeah.
What?
Starts at the end of January, yeah.
Oh, mate.
Yeah, so I'll be up there until the end of March. So it's been a bit of a whirlwind, but it's, luckily I've managed to do stuff on my own. And I think it's just about that work ethic, isn't it? Like writing to people and trying to figure out what's going on.
Yeah, because I think what, we're taught, as young actors and stuff like that, and coming out of drama school, that if you don't have an agent, you're a failure.
Yeah.
You failed.
Yeah.
And you're not going to get anywhere.
Exactly.
Which, and you do hear, some horror stories, Dunlop didn't, she was agentless for a while, it was difficult. It was difficult. Yeah. I mean, she has an added sort of, I don't know what you would call it, handicap, because she's Irish, and just, there's a limit on what she can kind of do, even though she's a crackerjack at accents. They don't fucking care.
Yeah.
But you've shown that, as long as you fucking grind it out, persevere, don't be a dick.
I think that's what it is. Like, once you get a job, be the nicest guy on that job. You know what I mean? Don't be a dick. Just don't be a dick, basically. It really helps.
You can be the worst actor
in
the world.
Yeah, but as long as you're nice, you're going to be all right.
We're going to be good to go then.
Yes. You could be the best actor and be a dick and not work because...
Yeah.
Why would you want to work with a dick?
Yeah, yeah.
Why would you want to do that?
Why would you want to, be locked in a room for 6 weeks?
Yeah.
Rehearsing with these a-holes,
Yeah.
So when you got Warhorse, because this is the cool thing about this show, it's so specialized.
Mm.
That's kind of why you came back, right? Yeah. In a way, because it's kind of like...
Because they know I can do it now.
It's like a temping agency. They're just get them back in.
Yeah, it really is. And everyone comes back because, everyone's injured or on holiday. Just because it is such a physical show, they'll just get people that have done it before to come back and help out, to get into the horse or to be ensemble.
So when you got cast the first time,
was
it with, so how does that work? Because when you get these shows that transfer, and you're kind of like, so, is that big director still attached? Like, is that, who's casting this thing?
Once it first transferred, Marianne was still directing it, and I think Alistair Kumo was still casting it. And then I think after the first cast change then, I think the associates became the sort of main directors, who is Catherine Ind and Alex Sims. And I think they got new casting directors involved. Marianne still overlooks it. She came in the other day, because I think they're doing NT Live with it, and so she came in the other day to make sure it's all right. And I guess it's still her baby, really, so she doesn't want to give it away too much.
Yeah.
She'll want to see it every now and again, and if it's not going the way she wants it to, she'll change it up.
Is that right?
I think so, yeah. I think she'll let the directors know. She'll be like, maybe we can do that differently or that differently.
Wow.
She's still very much hers, but she's left it in their capable hands.
Sure.
She trusts them completely, I'm sure. But then sometimes when the cast change happens, it's not everyone that leaves. It might only be half of the cast that change, or like a handful of them, or it could be five people that stay and the rest are new.
Yeah.
So that's always a bit odd nice because... some people know the show, so they can sort of pass that on to you and say, look, well, this is what we've learned to do at this moment. This might be the easiest way to do it. Because it's a beast of a show. If it's 35 people learning that show in 6 weeks, it's a tough old call. And people learning puppetry.
So what was that like? You had to learn...
Yeah, so I all that had stuff. To learn how to do the baby horse and...
Where do you go for that?
Where'd you study
that? They send you to Paris? Do you know what I mean?
It's in the crock, yeah.
Where did they teach you that shit?
Well, that's what's so good, is that I think they want actors to puppeteer rather than getting puppeteers to do it, because actors sort of put something else into it. And so they give you 2 weeks at the beginning where you've got two people, Finn Caldwell and Toby Olier, who are sort of masters of this sort of stuff. And they'll just teach you for 2 weeks intensely just like how to do it.
Is it like in a rehearsal space or is that
on stage? Well, we did it at the American Church, which is just by
Gooch Street.
And then you'll get on the stage sort of after a week or so, and because the stage is like ridiculous, it's not a flat stage, it's like bumpy, you know, like it's all over the shop,
right?
And so all of a sudden you're on a bit of carpet with this horse, like, yes, this is easy, like, and then you're like, you get on the stage and you realise it's not.
it's not at all.
No. This isn't going to be fun.
I'm going to
change my mind.
Yeah. I want to go back to that office. Yeah, where's that office job?
Office. Come on. Just call me, please. Usually you want in like auditions, but no. With this job, you want an office job.
And so what are some of the injuries that happen to people?
Well, because of the stage and like some of the weight, I think the horses weigh about 12 stone. So they're carrying that around for 2 hours, and sometimes there are people on it, and you know what I mean? People riding a horse. So sometimes it could be like 25 stone, you know, like, and so like you get like people with knees, bad knees and bad backs. And that's sort of mainly, that's it mainly actually, bad knees and bad backs.
Yeah.
And because the stage is sort of really bumpy, you're just like trying to run around on it and you're sort of out of joint. And your body's just shouting at you, like, what are you doing? What are you doing? And so then you have to go off for a week or so.
And do you go to, like massage or?
Yeah, they've got physios, in-house physios here. They're here six days a week.
Yeah.
You get like 20 minute slots, proper like sports massage. It's not nice, but it helps.
Yeah.
You know, like they really dig in deep. And you can get like a couple of slots a week.
Yeah.
But yeah, they're here all the time looking after you, listening to your what's wrong. They'll look at the way that the puppet is on top of you. And so if the weight can be shifted slightly so that your body's more in line.
Yeah, yeah.
You know, all that sort of stuff, because people will break otherwise, and they have to look after their people.
Like, yeah.
They have to look after you. So, yeah, they've got in-house physios, they've got a nurse that comes once a week.
Oh, wow.
Yeah, you know, proper warm-ups. They do, like, Pilates, do warm-ups before each show.
Yeah, yeah.
Get yoga teachers in, stuff like that.
So, yeah. So it's not like 1890s.
No.
Get in the horse, boy!
Yeah, exactly. It's not like turning up at the half with a glass of red wine. Like, I'll be fine.
So I just want to clear this up. So when you did the first Warhorse...
Yeah.
And then when you did the play of the Old Vic...
Yes.
And then when you came back to Warhorse... Yeah. Did you have an agent at all during that?
No. Not at all.
So I just want to make this clear. No agent was getting a commission while he did these three. No, you guys lost your 10%. That also felt good.
Felt really good. But I was also like...
We won!
Yeah.
Our side won for once!
For once.
Yes!
Don't get me wrong. I was like, look, if you sign me, I'll go
backdate
back,
it.
Yeah,
I'll backdate it.
For 3 years. You know? Just sign me. Please. No, John, no. We don't want you. We don't want
it's
you.
Just
thanks.
Gonna be a no. So you do this till Jan and then you go to West Yorkshire.
Yeah, so I've got this for another week and then I've sort of got 2 weeks before I head up to Leeds, start rehearsing up there for a month and then perform for a month. And then who knows? Selling cheese again at Borough Market.
Yeah, boy. Oh, yeah, that's what you do for your day job.
Yeah.
You sell cheese now? Are those tomatoes?
It was tomatoes, and now I've moved on to cheese. Just because they could offer me more shifts.
Brilliant.
So at Borough Market, selling cheese. God. Those cold winter months.
That's all right, man. I'm glad you got your agent finally.
Yeah. Yeah, which is great news. And they seem great, like, just on it, you know.
Of Mice and Men.
Yeah. Yeah.
We're going to have to do, like, a revisit.
Yeah.
I'll come up to West Yorkshire. Yeah, we'll do another one.
Oh, mate. Got to.
Curly's a fucking awesome part.
Yeah, I'm really looking forward to it, actually.
Yeah, man.
Yeah. Yeah, it's going to be great. And Mark Rosenblatt, who's directing it, he's the associate there, and I think he's, like, done stuff at the National Studios and stuff like that.
Yeah.
So yeah, I think it'll be great. I'm hoping it's going to be great.
Do you know who your Lenny is?
I can't remember his name. I know George is a guy called Henry Pettigrew.
For real?
Yeah.
I know Henry.
Do you?
Yeah. I did a workshop of Hairy Ape with him, a 2-week workshop, and at the Southwick.
Oh, yeah.
And then he did, oh, man, did I tell you about that Troils and Cressida thing? I did, didn't I?
I think you did, yeah.
When I was on my first year at Lambda? Yeah, with the fucking slope. Crazy slope. Jesus. He played Troilus.
Oh, did he?
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah, drop my name.
Yeah, definitely.
Yeah, he's cool.
Yeah?
He's cool, yeah, all right, yeah.
Good.
Well, right on, man.
Yeah.
Did we do it? Is that it?
I think we've done it, mate.
Yeah.
We did it.
What time's your next show?
My show is at 2:30, but I'm going to get some physio.
Are you?
Yeah.
Bad boy. So what is that? Is this what time you usually show up?
I usually get here about 12.
Yeah.
Sort of start warming up and stuff like that. Get a coffee maybe, but I might try and get some physio now.
Yeah.
And then get some lunch and stuff.
Then kick it.
Kick it.
Do you have 2 shows today?
2.
Is it 8 a week?
8 a week.
Ooh!
Standardo, mate.
Standardo! All right, tell the folks what the show is, what time it's on, and when it goes to, when you're in it, because they want to see you.
Well, at the moment, Warhorse, but you don't know about that, because you know about that. So, West Yorkshire Playhouse,
yeah.
of Mice and Men, opens on the 29th of February till the 30th of March, and I think that'll be 8 shows a week, so 7:30 shows, 2:30 matinees on Thursdays and Saturdays, I think. And so I'll be up there for a month, so...
Don't miss it.
Yeah, head up there, man.
Nice. That's yeah. John Trindle, folks. Thank you. See you soon.
Boom! There it is. There it was. My chat with John Trindle. Be sure to subscribe in iTunes to Dressing Room Confidential. Be sure to like the Facebook page. And be sure to follow DRC Pod on Twitter. Or just follow me on Twitter, Sean McConaughey. No, it's not spelled like Matthew McConaughey. And also, if you're going to subscribe in iTunes, please, please, please give us a rating. It's the best way for others to discover the show. So that's about it for me. Next up on DRC is going to be a chat with Tristan Sharix, who is a great dude. Great dude. It's probably one of the best ones we've done yet. Didn't know anything about him. Turns out he's a very, very interesting guy. Founder and member of Knee High. Awesome actor. Awesome dude. So look out for that. It's probably going to drop next week. But that's about it for me. This is Sean Mack signing off. The never working actor. Out!